from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back to listeners. Our first guest today is an award-winning writer, author, and educator who recently wrote for Zora.medium.com, an essay called The Day My Outrage Went Viral. And in it, she addresses racist attitudes against her brown daughter that energized her to raise her voice. So please welcome to the show today, writer Mathangi Subramanian.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
I said that pretty well.
Yeah,
Mathangi. Yeah. There we go. Wonderful. Mathangi, yeah. Thank you so much for being with us. So we really enjoyed your piece.
Yes.
First of all, tell our listeners a bit about what happened to you and that led you to write this piece.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for reading it.
Yes.
I really appreciate that it resonated with you. So basically what happened was I had been living in India for about 6 years, and that's where I adopted my daughter. And we moved back to the U.S., and we were staying at my mom's house in Bethesda, Maryland, which is a suburb of D.C., and known to be pretty diverse and pretty progressive and all of those things. And I took her to the park a few days after we landed, and it was one of the first times she'd been to the park in the U.S. And she saw a couple of blonde kids on, like, the slides, and she ran over to play. My daughter's already very shy, so I was pretty excited to see her doing that. And as soon as she ran over, one of the girls turned around and said, "You're not blonde, you can't play with us." So immediately my heart sank, because it was like me in the 1980s growing up in the Midwest.
Yes.
It was like a major flashback. So no one ever stood up for me back then. So I stood up for my daughter, and I said to these girls, you know, you can't just not let someone play in a park because they don't look like you. And the upsetting thing to me, I mean, it was upsetting that the kids said this, obviously, because, you know, racism is never okay. But it was even more upsetting to me that their parents were just standing there, who I assume were their parents, were just standing there and watched everything and heard everything and watched me and said nothing.
Wow.
Yeah, and to me, that was just a sign that these girls learned this from somewhere. I mean, that my daughter at the time was 3, and these girls, you know, were not much older than her. So they learned it from somewhere, and I'm not saying they learned it from their parents, but the fact that their parents didn't intervene was very upsetting to me. And even if they didn't teach racism, the fact that they were letting it happen meant that, to me, that they were condoning it.
Yeah,
so
because
it was really important to me to intervene.
Yeah, because were the parents or caretakers of the little girls who tried to shade your daughter due to racism, were they at the park that day,
like,
sitting there?
Yeah, they, like, saw what happened, right?
Yeah, they were right next to. I mean,
oh, wow.
They were standing right next to us. Right there. Yeah. And they said and did nothing.
Oh, wow.
And I can't say I was shocked. And part of me is sympathetic, because I feel like, you know, sometimes you don't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you don't know what to do. But I was saying things and doing things. So I could have just jumped on board with me,
yeah,
and been like, yeah, what the brown lady's saying.
And the first
you
thing
know?
That parents teach them is, kids, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. So
yeah.
Even if they don't know how to address the notion of color and difference, they can say to their child, hey, that was not nice, right? Like, in the
yeah.
very simplest. And I think we talk about white folk in America, especially, like,
mm-hmm.
they get excused because they don't know the appropriate way to handle
mm-hmm.
it. And I think that they do, like, even if they don't teach their kids this racism,
yeah.
they allow it to fester, right? So all the stuff in the news, you know, it's like, okay, so even if your parents did not teach you these things, they certainly saw the things, did not correct them. Yeah, I mean, yeah. That's.
I mean, it's just, it's beyond odd, and I also think it's, you know, beyond excusable. The caretakers or parents should have said something, if anything, to console you or to
yeah.
say to you
yeah.
how sorry
daughter,
they were,
yeah.
As opposed to, like, if they didn't have the lessons or the tools to teach their kids different in that moment, in that second, the least they could have done was apologize to you and reprimand their children in some way. But you, this incident in the park in your piece, you actually draw to an experience of your daughter's first time in the United States and her first interaction with, you know, this idea of citizenship and borders, and, you know, talk to our listeners about how your daughter's first visit to the U.S. was and what happened.
So, like I said, my daughter is adopted, which means that her citizenship path is not as clear as if she had been a biological child. So when we first visited the U.S. from India, this was in November of 2017, I believe. Yes, that's right. And the Muslim ban had just passed. And it's very timely we're talking about this because today, the 25th, they're actually having an appeal on the Muslim ban, which is crazy because it's like almost exactly 2 years later. So it's still on the books. And so we got to immigration, and my daughter was traveling on a tourist visa because we weren't eligible to get her citizenship. And the guy at the counter, the CBP officer, who was also a person of color, was like, "What's going on here? How come you don't have a passport for your child?" And I at first was like, "Ha ha ha, I would love a passport. Do you have one?" That did not go over well. But I explained to him that, you know, she's adopted and, you know, we do want her citizenship in process, but we have a 2-year residency requirement with her, so we can't, you know, apply for yet. Interesting. Okay. So then he sent us to detention, which was awesome because we had been traveling for 20 hours with a 2-year-old. And then we were in Dulles in the secondary screening room for another 2 hours while she wandered around and was basically at the end of her rope, and we all were. And then eventually, when we got called, the officer who we got to speak to in secondary was really nice. And he was like, "Look, I'm really sorry. This was a big misunderstanding. This won't happen again." He started a file for my daughter. So my daughter has had an immigration file since age 23 months, not even 2 years old. And he was like, "Okay, now you can be on your way." But the thing that happened to me is that I was so scared because I'd heard about the Muslim ban, and right around that time, families belonged together in the camps, that news was breaking. There was no clear sense of who was getting penalized and who wasn't. And I had friends who looked like me who were getting stopped at airports and getting their Twitter feeds and Facebook checked.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I'm a writer, so I'm active on social media. So I took myself off of social media, and I was just silent for 2 years until we got here. And, you know, my daughter's citizenship is still in process, but after that incident in the park, I realized my silence was not protecting me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned that the officer who finally kind of let you all go mentions that he's going to put a note, a quote-unquote note, in your daughter's file. Talk a bit about the figurative implications of that, the notion of a brown child, of an immigrant, of a woman, of a queer person, of any kind of other, having this notion of needing a file, right? So as a black person, I think about as, for enslaved Africans, a walking paper, right? If you're an enslaved African, mm-hmm. you want to go from here to there, you need a paper, right? Mm-hmm. Or, if someone thinks you're brown, you need some kind of, you know, citizen.
Yeah,
you know,
proof
like,
that you belong. Yeah,
so what are the implications about the notion of someone having to have a file, right, just because they're different? And then how will you teach these lessons to your daughter as she gets older? How will you help her understand that, number one, these things exist, but that she cannot internalize them, right? So in the same way that black parents have to talk with their children about the harsh realities of being black in America, but also simultaneously teach us to not internalize this as being our own faults.
That is such a great question. I don't know if I have the perfect answer for it. But honestly, one of the reasons I was so upset about what happened at the park is that families of color don't have a choice about talking about race or immigration, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, we got back from when we moved this time, for weeks, my daughter was walking around with a file full of construction paper playing quote-unquote immigration.
Wow, really?
I don't even know what that meant to her. But, you know, we're filing more papers now, and she knows she had to, like, stand in front of a white wall for 45 minutes while we tried to get her passport picture.
Oh, wow.
You know, so she's very, she's already aware of a lot. But I try to do, you know, honestly, I take examples from black parents and queer parents about just teaching our kids that they're enough and teaching them that no matter what the world says to you, like, you know, an article came out a few years ago saying you shouldn't call your daughters beautiful because it makes them focus on their looks. I call my daughter beautiful all the damn time because, you know,
yeah.
People aren't necessarily going to. They're going to look at her and see her as a threat. They're going to look at her and see her as somebody who needs a file at the age of 2, you know, which to me makes me think of like the lists of names that they used to have after 9/11. I had so many friends who were Muslim who had really common names like Muhammad Shah or something, and they were on that list of potential terrorists. And that's like putting Joe Smith on a list of potential terrorists, you know? So I just think about all the things that she's going to go through and the things that I've been through, and I just try and help her appreciate who she is and appreciate our culture. And I do feel like one thing I have that my parents didn't is I grew up as a person of color here. So I do have coping mechanisms. It's just a matter of digging and figuring out what they are, because they're so automatic now that I don't necessarily always know what I have to teach her, if that makes sense.
No, it makes total sense. Toward the middle of the piece, you talked about how you went silent and how you, you know, disappeared from social media. And then, you know, 2 years later, after the incident with your daughter at the airport in her first trip, your daughter is now a permanent resident. She has green card in hand. And you start really talking about xenophobia, racism, your encounters. And you had all this affirmation about your experience in the park. I mean, people were kind of retweeting and, you know, making this go viral. How did that feel? I mean, you mentioned in the piece that it felt wonderful and it felt supportive. But talk to our listeners a bit about what it felt like to share a story and have that story amplified over and over and over again, where people are co-signing and also supporting and listening. Yeah. How did that feel?
It was really amazing. I mean, I have to say that thread has so few trolls on it and so much support on it. And it was really life changing for me, because I had been living in India when Trump was elected. Mm. And, you know, there's just this feeling of fear that you get from watching the news from far away, and this feeling of helplessness of not being there, and this feeling of like, how is my community coping? Why aren't I there with my community? So it was nice to just remember that we are the majority, you know, they're not the majority. At least that's what the vote said during Hillary's last election. And that's what I keep telling myself.
Exactly.
But, you know, we're a powerful voice, the people who are right and the people who are people of color and who are somehow othered. Right.
Yeah.
And it was just nice to, because the people who are in the news are not our people necessarily. Right. So it was just nice to remember that there is a community out there. And I thought that I had left that community, but they never left me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, certainly. Once you saw the outpouring of responses in support of yourself, you kind of exhaled, right? And you didn't even realize that you were even holding your breath, you say. You say that you thought that you were protecting your daughter by keeping silent, but now you wondered, quote, if your silence was keeping you safe, was keeping her safe, or rather contributing to a culture that enabled such behavior. Talk a bit about the reflection you had and the self-reflection you had about your own decision to be silent, right? And how maybe that was even similar to those mothers in the park that day.
Yeah, so, you know, all of this time I could have been speaking out against all of these policies that were happening, but I didn't, because I was so afraid for my family and my daughter. And I think that that is a natural response. And I think people who have a lot less privilege than me are put in that position all the time, and I respect that position. But the fact is that I have a community, and I have power, and I have resources. And the fact that my daughter was detained, I mean, she had her paperwork, right? So it, at that point, I mean, things have been happening now that make me question this, but at that point, nothing really was going to happen to her, which is very clear in retrospect. And I feel that sending my family to secondary screening was a way to intimidate us and to keep us silent. And so right now, I'm more vigilant about whether things are actual threats or just part of kind of a plan to silence people. And I know that sounds like conspiracy theory, and it might not be a conscious thing, but there are so many ways in which people of color and women in particular learn to silence themselves.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to unteach myself that, and to realize that my voice, even if it's one voice, even if I have like only a handful of Twitter followers in my community and in my family, that voice is powerful.
Certainly.
And, you know, silencing it doesn't actually do me as much good as I think that it does.
Yeah, what I would say, like, as someone who's been a BLM activist for a long time, and of course activist, I can relate, certainly, and I have to remind myself not to be too tough on myself when I choose to be silent or to kind of quiet down a bit, because unlike those white parents in the park that day, for us, it's a matter of life and death, quite literally, right? So as brown folk, as women, as queer folk, sometimes us speaking up can get us killed, right? For them, it's like uncomfortable or uneasy or a little awkward. And so that's, so even though we may make the same decisions, we make them for vastly different reasons. And so that's just what I tell myself about it, yeah.
Yes, yes, yeah. And thank you so much for being so vulnerable and honest around your piece. You also have a book, People's History Heaven.
People's History of Heaven. Talk a bit about that book that's out now.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you for your wise words. That was very helpful to hear. So
thank you for that. Yes.
So the book that's out now, it's called The People's History of Heaven, and I wrote it while I was in India. And it's the story of five girls who are growing up in a slum in Bangalore that is about to be destroyed by the city. So it's an intergenerational story of them and their mothers and grandmothers and what it means to grow up in poverty in India from a female perspective, which you don't often see. And the characters are quite diverse. There's a trans character. There's a queer character. There's a disabled character. There's characters with mental illness. There's, you know, There's several queer characters, actually, but I shouldn't say that because that's actually giving away a reveal.
Okay.
But yeah, so that was one of the reasons that we moved back when we did it, because we moved back in time for my book tour to start. So it's been really amazing having the book out too, because that in combination with this, I think has, you know, I've met so many readers who are just so interested in lives outside of their own. And it took so much research to write characters that were outside of myself, but to have readers read those characters and identify with them and to really appreciate the fact that there are diverse characters in this setting that, I mean, people think of India as like one country, and India has, I think, 70 official languages. And, wow. You know, there are queer people there. There are trans people there, yeah. You know, it's a huge country. So it's been really rewarding to just have people connect with the book on a lot of different levels, and also to represent the place where my daughter was born, where my husband was born, where my parents were born in a different way that I think has been seen thus far.
I love it.
Yeah.
I
mean, yes. How can some of our listeners keep up with you and your work and the different cities you're going to be in your book tour? Like,
follow your writing. Yeah.
Yeah, and follow your writing.
So I'm on Twitter again. So my handle is Mathangi Writes. It's MathangiWrites. So I post most of my events on there. I also keep like an updated list of events on my website. And I do have a lot of stuff happening in the Bay Area where I live in the fall. And then hopefully in kind of other places in the winter, because the paperback version is coming out in January.
Wonderful. Listeners, I guess it has been Dr. Mathangi Subramanian. I apologize.
That's right.
Good,
yes.
Good. Okay, good. I'm bashing it. Hey, listen, it has been a delight having you with us. We wish you and your daughter and your family the best of luck. Thank you for sharing your experiences, being so vulnerable with us. And we're just with you in solidarity, and we appreciate you making time for us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me, and I appreciate your podcast.
Bye-bye. Be well.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you.
All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. Tell the people who we be.
You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast. The work we do on Strange Fruit wouldn't be possible without your support. If we've made you laugh...
or made you think...
we hope you'll consider chipping in.
Visit donate.strangefruitpod.org.
Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Well, thanks so much to today's guest for a really wonderful conversation. Doc, let's talk about some juicy fruit. You got a couple of stories, right?
Yes. So this story came out October 15th on AP News. Deputies ask a man to quit calling 911 about a stolen marijuana.
He called not only once, but he called several times.
He's been calling several times. So authorities say a Florida man repeatedly is calling 911.
In Florida.
Is repeatedly calling 911 to report that his roommate stole his marijuana.
Okay.
A deputy from the Pasco County Sheriff's Office posted a Twitter response to the man's call Saturday night and just said, "Stop calling."
maybe weed is legal there, but even if it is legal, I'm sure they're not coming. So, is weed legal in Florida?
No, it says recreational marijuana use is illegal in Florida.
Okay.
Deputy Neil Salva says in the Twitter video that he called the man back to tell him to quit contacting the sheriff's office about his stolen marijuana. Salva recorded the video as part of the agency's tweet-along program, which allows viewers to get behind-the-scenes look at the police work that deputies do. A sheriff's office spokesman said that there were no charges filed against the caller. They just were urging the caller to stop calling. The caller swore that his roommate stole his recreational marijuana and wanted 911 and the deputies in Florida to do something about it.
I guess I should count his blessings. That's really cool that they're just like,
oh my God.
Like, dude, we're not going to come lock you up, but like, stop calling online.
I mean, it's just so hilarious to me. Like, it do take nerve. Like,
well, yeah, to call the police and be like, yeah. Well, that happens more often than you think about how they say that people will call 911 to report a crime against themselves, but they've also committed a crime against somebody else. Like, they'd be like, me and my homeboy robbed this bank, and I was supposed to get half the money, and he just ran off with all of it. Can you please go? And they're like, you know what I love?
Oh, my God.
That happens on court TV shows, too, where, like, someone might be committing welfare fraud together, and then one person takes all the money, and the judge's like, you can't use me to enforce something that's already illegal. Or, like, if you're illegally squatting, you know, like... This is how
oh my God! It's just too funny to me that was like the funniest.
I would probably pay money to hear the 911 call because I'm sure the dude was blown. I'm sure he was already high, like, whatever little bit he had left. He's like, well, let me go ahead and smoke whatever little bit we got left.
Yeah, like, look, I'm about to call the police on my roommate. I mean, I just, when that came across my newsfeed, I fell out.
Yeah, that's right. I love it. But no, if you can literally Google, there's a whole phenomenon called a Florida man or a Florida woman.
Okay.
Because, and the premise is that most stories of the weird, news of the weird,
is happening in Florida.
So
really?
Like, go on your phone and just Google a Florida man.
Okay.
And you'll see all kind of weird, like a Florida man married a goat. A Florida
Why?
Man.
What is going on with Florida where where strange news stories come out of Florida?
I don't know if there's like,
like
an alien landing happened there or something. No shade to Floridians. We love y'all.
Maybe because it's still the South, but it's like tropical. I don't know.
But what's it got to do with anything?
I don't know. I mean, I always believe that the environment and like the earth and
impacts people's buck.
Yeah, just their buck ways. So yeah. Well, that's hilarious.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. So, but I want you to Google a Florida man or a Florida woman. And
I am.
See like all the buck kind of stories.
I'm going to.
We could probably do Juicy Fruit every single week based off of a Florida person.
I think that is hilarious. I didn't know that.
But you said you have another story as well.
I do. So one of our faves. Our fave Billy Porter.
Billy Porter from Pose.
Yes. Billy Porter. So according to Broadway World, Billy Porter is reported to be rumored that he is going to be joining the cast of the upcoming Cinderella from Sony movie.
Yeah.
And he is actually going to be cast as a Cinderella's fairy godmother.
Fairy godmother. I think I think it's actually confirmed that he will be indeed playing.
I'm just so excited about
it. If I'm not mistaken, a pop star is in talks to play Cinderella. I don't quite remember. I'll have to Google that too. But yeah.
And another fave is also in the same story. Our fave and friend to the show, who we've interviewed, Idina Menzel, is going
to
be joining the cast as the evil stepmother.
The evil stepmother.
I
love Idina Menzel.
I love her.
John's mother calls her Adele Dazeem.
Oh my God. But you know, she's my favorite, and I love her voice. I love her singing voice. And wasn't she in Wicked or nah?
She originated the role of Elphaba in Wicked.
Okay.
She originated the role of Maureen in
Maureen. Yes.
Maureen.
Okay,
yes. What else has she done? She, the voice of Frozen.
Oh, yeah. I love her voice. I could hear her sing all day. Yeah. And it's every rare. It's actually, okay, I walk down the street. Yes. Okay, don't get me started. Okay. No, don't get me started at all. Please don't.
Yeah, I love
because
Idina.
I can't. Menzel's voice is, no.
Yes, I love Idina. But
so,
no,
like,
we love Billy Porter.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think that there's talks for Camila Cabello, who used to be in the group Fifth Harmony.
Okay.
To play
Cinderella.
So, I really love what's happening now. And it really happened, damn near 20 years ago, when Cinderella on TV had the multiracial cast. And of course,
oh, my God. Here we go with Brandy. Brandy Norwood. I knew I could not say Cinderella without you bringing up Brandy Norwood. We all know that's bae for you. We all know that it remains bae.
Can I finish my story, please? I was going somewhere with this. Okay?
I knew you was going to bring up Brandy. Okay, okay.
The vocal bible, Brandy Norwood, playing Cinderella.
Yes.
Whoopi was the mother.
Yes.
There was like an Asian prince, a white daddy. And I loved it, right?
I love
still,
it.
Still, no matter what kind of TV shows were remade or movies were remade, it was still like an all-white cast. And so I love that, like, lately you're not having these multiracial casts of like Disney remakes and stuff. I think that's really cool.
I think it's cool too, but I love how
shout out to Brandy Norwood.
Okay, but I just love how much that particular film made such an imprint and an impact on you. I love it.
Yeah, but
you
just appreciate it. Because of Brandy and like her singing and Whitney singing and Whoopi Goldberg. It was just cool. I love it.
But I agree with you. I just think that sometimes the general public has no memory or recall. I mean, the controversy about Ariel being played by a black girl, the controversy even with them casting Billy Porter. I mean, folks are kind of outraged, like, why are you casting him to play a fairy godmother? It's like, why not?
Yeah.
And I do think that it's very telling that a movie with a really racially diverse, racially rich cast came out in the 90s that everyone seems to have forgotten about.
Well, only because of the TV movie.
I mean,
And
we didn't, I guess, you know, it might have been controversial, but we didn't have social media the way we do now, so we don't know. People might have been just as outraged about that, but because we didn't have social media, we didn't even have to look at their tweets or look at their Facebook posts.
Yeah, like,
so.
It was 20 years ago. Yeah, so I love it, and so I definitely will be watching. I'm looking forward to all like, the new musicals and both of the Little Mermaid remakes.
Yes.
And this one, and just, you know, they can just redo musicals and cartoons all day long, and I'm on board, child. You know that, but...
Me too.
Well, I had fun with you today.
I had so much fun with you today, as always.
Yes, and thank you to our guests, but for now, we are out of time, so Doc, please say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our engineer is Koji Toshiro, who also composed our theme music. For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters. Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.